Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. I'm Alan Wilson, I'm the host of the podcast, and each week the podcast aims to give you the opportunity to reflect on some of the things that make up a leadership journey. So far, the episodes of the podcast have seen me talking to Gemma Brown about my research on crucibles and Christian leaders. You can catch up with those earlier episodes on iTunes. But today we're going in a different direction, slightly different direction, in that this is going to be the first of a series of interviews with leaders. It so happens to be that my co-host Gemma Brown thought it'd be a really good idea that her interview with me would be the one to kick off the series. So get yourself something warm to drink, get a mince pie, as long as you get all your Christmas shopping done, put your feet up beside the fire and get ready to have a listen.
So I think that it's important that we hear your story and hear how it links into your research and what your experience of a crucible has been, what your leadership journey has been. So maybe if you could start us off actually just giving us a timeline of your leadership journey so far.
A timeline of my leadership journey so far. How far back do you want me to go?
Go way back to captain of the hockey team.
Captain of the hockey team. Cricket team.
Oh, cricket, sorry. Whoops.
I was head boy, mm-hmm. which, you know, they have to pick somebody every year. And I looking back on it, I think it probably, I probably, at that stage in life, I was a very responsible individual. And
at that stage, has it changed?
comment on that. But at the, I was probably regarded as more responsible than most of my peers. Mm-hmm. And so that was my reward for that. And at the same time, we had a house system in the school, you know, sort of grammar school thing. And I think I was the vice captain of the house at that point. So, So head boy, which goodness, yeah, that was a thing.
Did you think of yourself as a leader then?
I don't think I thought of myself as a leader.
But you knew you were responsible.
Well, it probably was that, and I don't think I particularly saw myself as a leader of my peers, although probably there was some element of that. I think there was some aspects of organisation and so on that had to be done, you know, organising the prefects and this kind of thing. So that was that. I remember then when I was at university, I was elected or appointed as the secretary of the hockey club. And again, I suspect that's not to do with any, you know, great, outstanding visionary leadership capacity. It's probably more to do with a sense of responsibility or something like that. So I did that. Had a small role as a leader of a Bible study group when I was at university. And then I think one of the things that began to happen probably around that stage in life was I began to get into preaching. Now, I know that, you know, I'm not saying at this stage that preaching is leadership. Although since I've mentioned it, I might as well say that actually it is, but certainly not the preaching that I was doing when I was about 19.
Oh, so what does that mean, though? So some preaching is, some isn't.
Well, I think a person who's a pastor or a minister of a church, who's a recognized leader of a church, one of the ways that they lead their congregation is through their preaching and their teaching, mm-hmm. Because it you know, it's an opportunity to shape what the church thinks.
Yeah.
How the church should behave, you know, it's an opportunity to state vision and mm-hmm. this kind of thing. So, but certainly the level of preaching that I was doing in you know, various little church fellowships dotted around the country would not have been regarded as leadership, I don't think, by anybody.
And this was, so you were brethren at this stage, so that was quite a normal thing for younger men to be brought up in church and being taught to preach, I guess.
The teaching to preach probably was a little bit random. There was nothing terribly organized. I mean, I did happen to have a good mentor when I was at university, not so much in relation to my preaching, but more in relation to Bible study.
Okay.
But I think you were kind of, you know, you were pitched into it. I just think there wasn't enough active, you know, feedback. I still think it's the same thing. You know, I still move a little bit in some brethren circles and... you know, I see that young guys again are given opportunities to say things And I wonder often, you know, is anybody going to have a chat with him afterwards? I think sometimes they should. And if they don't, and I fear that a lot of the time they don't, if it doesn't happen, then I think there are huge opportunities, huge numbers of learning opportunities that actually get passed up because somebody stands up there and talks. And, you know, if they don't do a good job, at least if what I would regard as a good job of handling the Bible, that needs to be sorted out. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're 25 and you're doing that, then you're probably still going to be doing it when you're 35. Yeah. Nobody has bothered to actually correct. So there's a, I mean, I suppose there's a leadership thing there as well.
Yeah, of course.
It's up to church leaderships, I think, not just to pitch people in with opportunities to do things, but also I think the mentoring thing has to kick in as well. It needs to be feedback. It needs to be, you know, even if it's not formal training, there needs to be some feedback and opportunities for people to learn.
Yeah.
And that's not just for preaching. I think for anything that people are doing, I think that kind of feedback is, I think that feedback is important.
Yeah.
I taught a Bible class in a couple of churches that we were in, along with, you know, with others. I was on some committees that were mission related.
Okay.
Including with my wife, in our early days. So we were involved. So there was a sense of leadership in that, of being part of these little teams. We, you know, for example, we would organize, you know, like regular prayer meetings for a mission organization and an annual kind of conference thing in Castle Welland Conference Center. So there were aspects of leadership in that. And also then I think, you know, probably my mid-20s then, I was involved in leading teams. So we would scoot off to France for a couple of weeks and do some evangelism with a church there. And, you know, on a few occasions I was asked to lead in those situations. So all of those were, I suppose, early leadership experiences. And I dare say, you know, I think I would probably make the same comment that I made about the preaching thing. There's not a lot of mentoring or training or coaching in that. And I think probably a lot of people of my generation or older would say that there was a lack of mentors.
Okay.
You know, that you just sort of pitched into doing stuff.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, you do it and you sink or swim. And presume if you sink, there's somebody will drag you out or something like that. And kind of, you know, set you back again. But there just wasn't enough formal stuff. I think we're more aware of all of this kind of thing now.
That's good.
You know, and I think, well, I hope when you're a different generation from me, obviously. You know, what do you think? Is there more?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the importance of mentoring is acknowledged more. I don't think that we've nailed it though. You know, I think there's reluctance on behalf of mentors to mentor because maybe we feel like we don't have enough to give or we don't want to push ourselves in that way or whatever. And then I think there's sometimes reluctance that we have to look for mentors because, again, well, you know, is this going to be a burden on someone? Or I think as well not knowing necessarily who to connect with, because I think a mentor isn't necessarily someone who's older. Often it is, but it could be someone who is ahead of you in a path. And I think sometimes actually tell us then, you know, how, if we're looking for a mentor, what should we be looking for? Or if we see ourselves as maybe a potential mentor, then how can we move forward with that?
It's a great question. I think a lot of people of my generation need to be doing it. You know, need to be involved in that. I think if you're looking for a mentor, I would say have a look at somebody that you think you could learn from.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid to ask them. You know, maybe don't scare them off with the mentoring word.
Yeah.
You know, will you be my mentor? You know, that might scare them off because they'll not think they're capable of it.
Sure.
But to say something like, you know, if you have the time, I think I would really enjoy if we could meet up maybe once a month, once every couple of months.
Yeah.
Just so that I could bounce some ideas around with you about what I'm about what I'm doing. You know, something like that. I think that's quite easy to ask.
It is,
And I think for older people, just don't be afraid. Don't feel that you're necessarily barging in. I think you know, if you say, if you identify a younger person that you think could benefit from a mentoring relationship, there's nothing wrong with saying, do you know, if I can be of any sort of encouragement to you,
yeah,
I'm happy to have an occasional coffee.
Great.
Mentoring, I think it can be a very broad term. It can be something that can be quite informal, maybe even infrequent.
Yeah.
I think it can be something that's a lot more intentional. It probably depends on the nature of the relationship. I think there probably are mentoring relationships that would benefit from, you know, say taking a book and reading it together. When I eventually write a book about all this crucible stuff, leadership journey stuff, I mean, joking apart, that would be one of the things I'd like to see come from the material that I've been working on.
Definitely.
Is to give people a mentoring tool, because I think, you know, and I'm back to talking about the research here, and, you know, we can come back to my story if you insist later. But I think going back to my research, there's a framework in there that I think helps people to view their own leadership journey, their own story. Mm-hmm. So this the kind of the nature of the crucibles and what's going on in the crucible experiences. Yeah. And I think for older leaders to have some sort of tool that gives them a framework to look at their own story has the potential to be very encouraging. Mm-hmm. And I think as well, and interestingly, I stumbled on something the other day that, you know, someone had won a prize from TED, you know, the TED Talk people, for work that he had done on just setting up a facility for people to interview one another about their stories.
Yeah.
There's value in telling your story, and maybe if I'm able to provide people with a framework to think about their story, but also then to talk about it with someone else, and maybe the older leader realizes some of the things they hadn't noticed before.
Yeah.
I think for younger leaders, there's an opportunity to look and say, well, here's a framework that helps me to see where my leadership journey might go.
Yeah.
And then I think if you put the two together, to my mind, an older leader who's using the material to look back, a younger leader who's using the material to look forward, and they're working on it together.
Yeah.
Goodness, I think there's a great opportunity there for them to tap into the experience, not just of what is in the research, but the experience of that older leader.
Yeah.
So that would be a hope that I would have.
Yeah, great.
For the work that some of that could come out. At any rate, the point here I'm making is, I think a lot of us when we were younger, we just kind of got caught up in aspects of leadership.
Yes.
Probably, and we didn't really think very much about it. We weren't reading the myriad books. I mean, I think I can't remember off the top of my head what the statistics are, but the exponential increase in the number of books that have been written on leadership, just generally, never mind from a Christian perspective, in the past 30-35 years, it is really quite extraordinary.
Sure.
There are folk who've done the research on that, and the numbers are amazing.
Yeah.
So we're much more aware of it,
yes.
And there are many more resources there, and we talk about it much more.
Yeah. Well, I guess books can act as mentors as well, can't they? Sometimes
they can.
When you don't have that face-to-face thing.
They
I think for my generation, another point on mentoring is that sometimes it can be quite informal. So one of my mentors at the minute is just someone that I admire. I like what they do in the world. And so we meet up quite informally, and I just listen to their story, really, and they sort of ask me hard questions, and it's coffee mentoring, I guess. But then one of my first mentors was Kristen Getty, who was in our church in Geneva, and she took me through the Psalms, and we had a list of 10 questions that we used each time in our notebooks that were matching. And, you know, she taught me a skill as well as letting me into her life. So I think it's okay for each mentoring relationship to look different, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's right. Those are good illustrations.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you may have different mentors as well. Maybe an opportunity to, you know, there may be somebody that you're in a position to meet with on a monthly basis. There may be somebody else, and it's a once a year thing
that you just don't have the
opportunity.
Yeah, and that's okay.
And peer mentoring as well. I think, you know, mentoring, probably the term implies one person's a bit further along the road than the other. But I think there's scope as well for peer mentoring. At that point, you may be looking at, you know, I would say young, for example, young leaders who are listening to this, go out and buy, you know, for example, Derek Tidball's new book, Lead Like Joshua, and read a chapter or a couple of chapters of that a week, and then meet once a month and discuss it.
Great.
Or another book that I would recommend to people, Resilient Ministry by Burns, Chapman and Guthrie, written about four or five years ago or so. It's an excellent book on different aspects of longevity in Christian leadership. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing that you can take and work with a group of people. Great. And encourage one another in that.
So let's actually add those titles then to the show notes so that people can have a list of things, right, that would be,
okay,
that would be useful.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of others. I could name a lot of others as well. But
yes,
anyway.
But that would keep us from you telling us your story, which is why we're here.
Yeah.
Do you have a leadership style?
Well, that's a really good question, and I've been teaching on leadership styles recently. There are various writers have talked about these kind of things, and I think one of the pieces that Bill Hybels has done, it's in his book Courageous Leadership, is quite helpful. It's very accessible, and it's quite helpful, mm-hmm, where he talks, I think it's about 10 different leadership styles. So there's a visionary leader, there's the strategic leader, there's the re-engineering leader, there's the shepherd leader, there's the... Do you know, he has a whole bunch of these things.
Okay.
That all would form part of a team. I've not been a visionary leader.
Okay.
If anything, I think my team style. If anybody's listening who's ever been on one of my teams, I think I'm a chef.
You know.
I remember looking at this a while back when I was involved in leadership and thinking I was most likely to be a shepherd type
when you were involved
leader.
In church leadership, yeah.
Uh-huh. Certainly, in Switzerland, uh-huh, that sort of style.
Yeah. And what does that look like for you then? What does that mean?
I suppose the relationships within the team are important.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, it's not having a sharp strategic mind.
Okay.
Or even being able to have a vision. I think I can communicate a vision, you know, and I think to varying degrees I've been able to identify things and be a front person for that.
Yeah, of course.
Someone was showing me around some premises that they've bought for outreach purposes. Just last week they were showing me this, an old pub.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just reminds me, I think I said to them at the time, you know, I'm not one of those people who looks at an old building and thinks, oh, wow, you know, if we owned that, we could do this, we could do that, we could mm-hmm, all of these other things.
Okay.
There are some leaders who are like that, who look at nothing and see something, or look at ruins and see a flourishing city.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly like that. I think I can, you know, maybe bring people together, mm-hmm, and I can communicate things. There probably is an element of, there's a bit of an element of strategic thinking
course.
As well
that's
in me. Those questions are probably hard to... They may be hard for me to answer. I think those are probably questions that would be better answered by people who have observed my leadership. And I know you have. I mean, it's kind of weird because you've grown up in churches that I have led. But you've observed my leadership, so maybe you see things about it that I don't actually see myself.
Well, I mean, I definitely would say that you definitely are a shepherd. You're a shepherd leader for sure. I think you probably underestimate your ability to communicate things, and, you know, ideas.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know what Bill Hybels' list is. In its entirety, but I guess you have an ability to take a complex idea or something that's quite intellectual and bring it to a level that is accessible to a lot of people, which I think is a skill that a leader needs to have. You have it in buckets.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I do think you're strategic. You're not the kind of person, no, who goes and sees something and then imagines what it is. You're maybe not a dreamer, but you are strategic. So I think, I mean, I guess no leader is one type only, are they? So...
Well, I think leaders have strengths.
Yeah.
They definitely have strengths. I mean, I'm a teacher.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that comes through what you say about, you know, an ability to take ideas and to break them down and communicate them. I suppose I can do that, or I can take and be a broad visionary concept and say, well, let's break that down into different areas and see how that might work out. And relate it to scripture and whatnot.
Yeah.
I probably enjoy doing that kind of thing.
Have you done Gallup Strength Finders?
I did over 10 years ago.
Okay. Be interested to see that.
Yeah. I mean, I've done some of the things. I can't remember the name of those. There's that many of those things that you do during the years. One of the things that I did had me come out as a steadier.
Okay.
Do you know?
Yeah.
Which in some ways is probably it's almost the antithesis of a leader.
Because
a leader, certainly a visionary leader, rocks the boat.
Okay.
A visionary leader, by definition, is not, you know, in favor of the status quo.
Okay.
This is a person who sees something needs to be done, and I'm going to stir things up so that it happens. You know, one of the distinctions between leaders and managers is the attitude to chaos. Mm-hmm. Leaders create chaos. That's how they lead and move things forward. But managers, their job is, well, to manage the chaos and bring the chaos into order. So they're bringing the chaos back into order, and the leader then is establishing new chaos. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm that kind of leader.
But no, the world needs many leaders and many types of leaders. So and not everyone could be freaking chaos.
I think if I was a bus driver, you know, and I was driving, if I was driving a coach load of passengers on a bus, well, I'd obviously be leading them, but you'd want it to be fairly steady.
Yes, that's true. I'm glad that you thought about
if the road was bumpy or something. Like, if the road was bumpy, you'd want a driver who's going to lead you, you know, that's going to steady the thing a little bit. It's almost going to stay steady the ship, but that would be mixing metaphors.
Well, and with the churches that you've led, you have steadied them, you know, through, and particularly with Wessex, which we'll come on to in a minute. You know, 17 years, it's a long time, and a lot is happening in the church, and you were that steadying presence, which I think makes sense.
Yeah.
Also, you are investigating the Enneagram, and we think that you're a 9, which would make sense, because that's a peacemaker and someone who can see all sides and bring people together, you know.
I think it's something that I've learned, is that. And I suppose, do you know, the peacemaker, the negative side of the peacemaker is somebody who wants to be liked or something like that, doesn't like the idea that there's dissonance where they're involved.
Yeah.
But I think I find that, I find dissonance with people can be difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like it, and I especially don't like to think that I've caused it.
No, that makes sense too.
Yeah. So, and I think to tell that against myself, I think those are things that probably limit my capacity as a leader, you know, certainly as a leader in the way in which many people understand the term.
People
are going to turn off this podcast. You're going to say, what is this, a leadership journey podcast? And here's a guy who's not a leader telling us why he's not a leader.
I don't think that's true at all. I think you're being self-aware.
I'm a scholar of leadership.
Well, but I mean, self-awareness surely is one of the most important parts of being a leader.
I think it is.
So, you know, knowing where we're strong and where we're not so strong.
I think so. So if anybody out there, again, is listening and they have grandiose ideas about themselves, just get real, you know. have a real view of yourself, because if you don't, and you try to push yourself into a place where you don't really belong, you know, then there's trouble.
Yeah, but we'd love to hear actually what type of leader you are, whether it's a Bill Hybels approved label or not. It'd be
You're
great
talking
to hear.
That lot out there.
Yes, yeah. No, I've heard about you. So,
okay. So they can contact us, which would be great. Love to know that there's somebody listening.
It would. And actually, just to pick up, so the Gallup Strength Finder we have done, I work for a Christian organization, and our leader got us as leaders to do it. And it's been really useful for us in our leadership to realize that these are our top 5 strengths. These are the things that maybe we're not so good at. And, you know, how can we then maximize what we're able to do as leaders through that? And we left off then, actually, before you even ended up in the church. So tell us then about sort of that transition between teaching Bible classes, being a roaming teacher in churches, and then becoming a pastor.
Yeah, well, my first career was as a language teacher. That's what I did a degree in French and trained as a teacher and taught for 8 years in a grammar school. I think my church involvement stuff was all going on around that time. So I'd be out, you know, preaching on a Sunday night somewhere, having a youth fellowship thing on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
And then to do my day job during the week. And I think, partly because I spoke French, and partly because I had an awareness of mission, both my parents and my in-laws had a huge missionary interest, and my father still does. So both Pauline and I grew up in an environment where there was a lot of talk about mission, and I think I've already said about being involved in summer stuff and whatnot. And I think we both had felt that we would one day end up in some kind of vocational Christian work.
Hmm.
In fact, I can remember being interviewed for my teaching job, and the head asked me that, you know, if he offered me the job, would I take it? And I said, I think so, yes. But I think I also said that it kind of indicated to him that my ambition was not to be a career school teacher.
Yeah.
he's a Christian, so he understood the kind of thing I was talking about. And actually, funnily enough, in that particular school, he lost quite a number of teachers who went off to various parts. There are actually two of us who started in the language department at the same time. The other one is now a professor at Union Seminary in Belfast.
Okay.
And we had similar journeys in some ways. We both started off teaching languages. He left a lot sooner than I did, trained for the Presbyterian ministry, and then found himself in France.
It's Graham.
Gordon. Yeah. And then you know, a number of years later, I followed a different track, but also ended up in, well, I suppose, continental Europe.
Yeah.
We'd been very involved in going to France, so, you know, spending summer times in France, helping churches and so on. And a number of our friends and even, you know, some of our family had gone off to France to be involved in church planting work. It was around the Easter time of 1989, so frighteningly, that's almost 30 years ago. At a point where we were, you know, we felt for sort of practical reasons that we were at a bit of a crossroads. Either we were going to put roots down in Northern Ireland, or else it was going to be time to move if we were going to go to France, or were, you know, as we thought it might be. And around that time, we heard, and I don't need to go into, I'm not going to go down all the alleyways of this particular story, but basically we heard about a church in Switzerland, French-speaking Switzerland, that had started about a year and a half previously, and they were looking for their first pastor. It had been started by an elderly couple. They were retired missionaries, a Swiss married to an English woman, and they'd actually met working with Amy Carmichael in India, you know, whatever number of years previously. He was a visionary. Philip was a visionary leader. And so along with a number of families from a church that was meeting, an international church that was meeting in Geneva, in the city of Geneva itself, they identified an area about almost halfway between Geneva and Lausanne along the shore of Lake Geneva, where there were increasing numbers of English speakers. They anticipated it, increasing numbers of English speakers, and they thought, well, this is going to have to be a church there.
Yeah.
So they planted the church. They were now looking for a pastor. And when we looked at it, we sort of, you know, initially weren't impressed or drawn to it at all. But as we began to think about it, we began to think, well, you know, maybe this suits how we see our own gifting. So we got in contact with someone we knew who was like a go-between. They asked us to come out then for a long weekend to be interviewed. Grilled, I think, was a better word, because it really was. It actually was extremely intense.
And you were how old at this stage?
30.
30, and you were a teacher at that stage as well.
Yeah, I was. I didn't have a formal theological qualification either. So, I mean, I remember part of that there. You know, sitting one of the evenings, sitting in a room, and there were, I don't know, 15, 20, I don't know how many people sitting around the walls in the room, and anybody in the room could ask us any question that they wanted.
Wow.
That was the interview, part of the interview process. I think there were probably other bits, and I had to preach and I had to lead Bible study, and you know, there were various things like that. Very, very intense weekend. And at the end of it, I think we thought, well, as we crawled out of Geneva and got back on a plane and came home, we thought, whoa, we don't really want to have to think about that for a while. The irony had been that they were viewing, you know, another candidate. He'd been out a couple of weeks before.
Yeah.
And he was about 10 years older than me. He'd had a career in business.
Okay.
And I thought, well, he's your man. anyway, they came back to us a couple of weeks later, and We had to make a decision. One of the elders of the church that we were attending came around and talked through stuff with us, and eventually we went back for a second visit. Then the church had a meeting, had a vote, and called us. Took a year to get there. There was you know, the residence permit thing was a bit slow.
Yeah,
took us a year to get there. So we got there in the summer of 1990.
Yeah,
left our little apartment in Bangor, and went off to Switzerland. And I still remember the Saturday and sort of being quite emotional going through the airport and, you know, speaking to the security man and sort of tearfully saying, we're emigrating.
And then you obviously stayed there for 17 years. Yeah. So, yeah. And we'll look at your experience then in more detail. Can we just go back slightly to when you were a teacher and also in ministry and leading?
Yeah.
Because my sense is that there will be people listening who don't identify themselves as, like, you know, in positions of paid leadership. Maybe they are elders, maybe they're starting a project, maybe they write, and that's a form of leadership too. So how can we manage that kind of situation? I know for me, my first formal experience of leadership was whilst I was also working at Caterpillar and starting a charity. And so, what's your kind of reflection on that stage?
Well, I think you have a responsibility to whoever employs you.
Yeah.
I think that's clear. But you also have a responsibility to any sort of other sense of calling that you might have. I don't think you should be so busy doing your kind of, your calling thing that you're having to skip days at work or something like that, or you're turning up late for work, or you become I don't think that's appropriate. There may come a time for people in that kind of situation where they cannot go on doing both things.
Mm-hmm.
And when that's a crucible,
mm-hmm.
because then you have to decide what are you going to do. You may then decide that you need to step away from
mm-hmm.
paid employment into the insecurity,
mm-hmm.
perhaps. I know you've been through this.
Yeah, of course.
With your earlier charity work. You step out into the insecurity then of following your calling. As I say, that's a crucible thing. It takes us back to some of what we talked about in last week's episode.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need to still be the best of what you're being expected to be, but keep nurturing your calling.
Yeah.
Don't lose sight of it. Don't let it get crushed. Because the other thing that can happen, I think, is that people can get on a career thing and lose sight of their calling and get to midlife and the flame of their calling has all but dwindled, and they've just got on to a kind of, do you know, the rat race thing, and it's the house and the cars and you know, the holidays and so on, and any sense of calling that may have been there in their 20s has all but gone.
Yeah.
And that's very, very sad.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and in a later episode, you will be looking at people who are leaders but not paid leaders. And
I think we'll probably need to bring someone in like that, because that it's a very big part of leadership. You think of the church in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
There are loads and loads and loads of people who are leaders of churches.
Yeah.
But they're members of teams, but they're not actually paid for what they do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll come back to that in a later episode. So you were at Westlake Church then in Neon for 17 years. Just describe quite briefly what the church was like.
Well, it was an international church. There were a number of Swiss people in the congregation, but many of the people were expats.
Yeah.
So they'd come from other parts of the world. Geneva for a long time has been home to expat communities. And, you know, for various reasons, the United Nations has its second office, its second global office there. World Health Organization is there. Many of the big global businesses have significant offices there for Europe and the Middle East and so on. So it's a real hub of international organizations and of international business. So lots and lots of people are coming, lots and lots of people are coming through there, you know, and it's got a very strategic position in the center of Europe. So we had folk, you know, sometimes we might have it up to about 20 nationalities in the church.
Mm.
Tended to be folk from a, you know, who were fairly successful.
Okay.
If you were a typist in, you know, in an organization in England, they were unlikely to send you to Switzerland. You know, that wasn't how it worked.
Yeah.
You know, doubtless there were people who came to work in maybe less skilled or less strategic jobs. But many of the people who come there are real high flyers.
Yeah.
They're very wealthy.
Yeah.
They've achieved a lot. Mm-hmm. They're highly intelligent. They're highly resourceful.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the kind of thing we were in. And actually quite funny. You know, there I was this little guy from Northern Ireland and all these high flyers. One of the most amusing things was the number of scientists that we had
in
the church. We weren't that far from CERN, the big research institute, University of Lausanne, the Lausanne Polytech, which is not the way we think of the way we used to think of polytechs in this country, but a very prestigious scientific school. People from various scientific disciplines who were working in these places and were part of the church. Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, me and science, goodness me, that was really that was a very odd relationship.
Yeah.
I found it very difficult to understand very much about science, but it was odd that there was me, you know, leading and teaching these people. And I think, you know, I can remember in the relatively early years of the time being there and visiting speakers coming to do events for us and saying, goodness me, how do you lead a place like this?
Yeah.
You know, someone says like a stable full of thoroughbreds.
Yeah.
People wondered, well, do these people really even want to be led at all?
Sure.
You know, these are the kind of questions. And maybe, you know, maybe they would have responded to me if I'd been a powerful visionary leader. But maybe at the same time, there was something about being a shepherding leader that actually meant that they weren't threatened.
Yeah.
You know, the leaders were given their voices.
Yeah.
The other dynamic in terms of the leadership was that there was a small established team of elders that was already functioning when I went there.
Mm-hmm.
I joined that team,
mm-hmm.
And although I was the pastor, I was one of the elders.
Mm-hmm.
I was the youngest one of the elders.
Right.
I also came from a church background, being Brethren, where we didn't have pastors.
No.
So I did not go there and think, right, I'm going to be the guy who's going to boss everybody around. You know, for one thing, I had no template for it,
mm-hmm.
but for the other, I was young.
Yeah.
And I actually think that probably contributed to what turned out to be a very healthy dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
People listening may be surprised and may think, oh, come on, a team needs a strong leader.
We did okay for
a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, we had our ups and downs. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't an entirely perfect thing, but we did okay, and it turned out to be quite a model. I think we went through things together. We learned things together.
Yeah.
And I think we grew together. And there was a tremendous value in that. Just sense of team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, those who are listening who lead as part of teams, I would say, and maybe there's a bias here, but I would say cultivate your team.
Yeah.
You've got to cultivate your team. If the unity of the team gets affected, that will affect the organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the team unity is very precious and very, very important.
Yeah.
The flip side of that, though, is that A tight team, which has its strengths, can actually become like a bit of a clique.
Okay.
You know, some people thought we were an old boys club.
Okay.
You know? And I think you can become, you know, you can almost become too tight.
Okay. Yeah.
And you know that then leads to another set of problems.
Sure.
Where, you know, if you're questioned, you tend to be defensive.
Yeah.
You close ranks. You maybe don't have enough of an ear for new ideas that are coming from outside the group. You know, there are all kinds of things like that. The team dynamic thing is a whole other, that's a whole other subject.
But I mean, you had a beautiful thing that happened with the eldership in Westlake, because you were, I wondered if it was in part because you were all from different places, and so you kind of almost became family in a little bit of a way. And, you know, you had like meetings, which Kiki, my sister, and I didn't enjoy at the time, but, you know, you brought them into the house, you drank Diet Coke. They were just very loud and laughed a lot, so we couldn't sleep. But, you know, that kind of thing, I think, made it a really unique team, didn't it?
It did. And There were aspects of, I mean, as you say, the sort of the lively chat on a Sunday night when we were having our meetings, and we worked pretty hard to cultivate the thing. I mean, we had quite a lot of meetings,
mm-hmm.
And I know that can be a challenge.
Yeah.
Now, one of the particular difficulties that we had with meetings and so on was the fact that a number of the guys travelled so much.
Yes.
So someone could be away for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And you're not going to wait until you couldn't wait until everybody was there before you had a meeting. But I think what needed to happen then in order to compensate for that was a level of trust needed to be built up when we were together and as we worked together so that if someone was missing, they could say, do you know, it's fine, I trust those guys, I trust the decisions that they'll make, you know.
Take us back to that sense of team being too tight.
Yeah, I will. There was something. There was another thing that I was going to say about the team as well. Yeah, the number. Can I just talk about the number of meetings that we had?
Yeah. So we had
one meeting in a month that was a Sunday night meeting after church, and it was a business meeting. You know, that was to do with the business of the church. We had a second meeting on a Sunday night per month, and it was for prayer.
Yes.
And I was very keen that that was never allowed to become, you know, a supplementary business meeting.
Yeah.
Because you get a lot of high-powered people around, and we all like to talk.
Yeah.
And we talk about problems and we talk about things rather than praying. So we made that very much, that was we're going to pray for one another.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have shared about stuff that was going on. We'd have prayed for one another. And then we would have prayed for pastoral situations and needs in the church. We also had... On a Friday morning, it went through various iterations as an actual get-together in somebody's house at 7 o'clock in the morning. Then when that became logistically more difficult, it was a conference call. And then when Skype came about, it was a Skype call.
Yeah.
But we used to Skype for half an hour on a Friday morning, and that was for prayer.
Yeah.
And again, there was no, you know, there was no 20 minutes spent chittering. And, oh, well, boys, there's 10 minutes to go here. Let's pray. We said good morning and we just got pretty much straight into it. And if there was anything that needed to be discussed, it would happen after the half hour that we prayed together.
Okay.
So we had that. We were also involved in church council meetings that was a wider leadership team. So there were a lot of meetings and that can take a toll and that can be very difficult. But the fruit of that, I think, was and probably not least the fact that we didn't just do business together, but we actually shared together and prayed together.
Yeah.
I think that was important.
Yeah.
And the tightness. So you asked me also then about the negative, about
a tight team, or even just not the negative, but you know, how can we look out for things? So if our team is feeling too tight, what's the sign of that? How can we make sure that there are? I don't know, avenues in which other opinions could come in?
I think you'd have to assess it in terms of how the wider group is relating to the team.
Yes.
So if you you feel that nobody wants to talk to you, that's probably a warning sign.
Mm-hmm.
I remember someone saying to me, you know, in another church when they'd become an elder, that they noticed relationships with friends changed.
Okay.
So if people have stopped talking to you or to your team, then there's maybe something that's going on.
Yeah.
I think if people are, you know, if people therefore think it's not worth their while saying anything to you, that's also worthwhile. I think if people are honest enough to say, we feel that you folk on the team have become very aloof and very distant from us and you're not really listening, you know, I think you need to be prepared to listen to that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think the instinct that many of us have when we're opposed is to close ranks and to shoot back.
Yes.
And that is really not very helpful.
No.
Because it simply widens the gulf.
Yeah.
And then eventually there comes a point where there is such a gap between the leaders and and the people, the followers who are coming along.
Yeah,
well, they're not coming along anymore.
No.
No, that makes sense. And there's discontent in the camp. Ideally, I think you should have a team that is clearly strong together, but there's something about their unity that spills out. There's a unity, but yet there's an openness.
Yeah.
And there's a non-defensiveness that invites. And in a way, that sort of attitude spills out. And I think for people to be able to look at a team of leaders and say, look, there's a wonderful team of leaders. They're so strong together, and yet they're so open.
Yeah.
You know, that's inspiring, I think, for people. People will then follow a team like that.
That's great. On a board that I chair, we often have a visitor come in to some of our meetings, so maybe once a month to see, for lots of reasons, but to ask them sort of hard questions about what they think of the health of the board and how that all works. And seeing how they even just relate to other board members is really useful to... It's a good barometer, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so Westlake, so you had a really great eldership there. You were there for 17 years. We'll get into the Crucible experiences there as well, obviously. But then you moved on to...
Port Stewart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I came back to Northern Ireland 10 years ago. It probably was a bit unexpected. I think if you'd asked me, if you'd said to me 2 years before it, it would have been unlikely. It's only 3 years before it. I think it would have been almost, you know, we really wouldn't have considered it at all.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't a person who would say, right, I'm going to go to this and I'm going to stay here for X number of years and then move on. After 17 years, I mean, the way it happened after 17 years in Switzerland, it wasn't that I said, oh, right, you know, this church is stagnating, it needs me to go. It wasn't a formal thing like that, really. As I said in a previous episode, we sensed that our roots had been loosened a bit and we were more open to moving to something else. Mm-hmm. But looking back at it, I think, you know, even for the good of the church, it probably was good in some ways that we moved on.
Sure.
I like to think there are one or two people who would probably quite like me to be back. But the length of time a pastor stays in a church is a very, you know, it's a, how long is a piece of string? It's a question that people take different views on. There are some church traditions that have very long pastoral ministries and people can be in them for a very long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Others, you know, like the Methodists, for example, there's a lot of, you know, sort of a lot of cycling in, cycling out.
That's right.
It's kind of built into the system.
Yeah.
Personally, I think there's value in a reasonably long period of time to be there.
Yeah.
And I felt in Switzerland that because the church, you know, the expat church, people were constantly coming and going. Mm-hmm. I felt with that it was important that there was a stability in leadership.
Yeah.
And you know, we had that for a long time.
Yeah.
At any rate, there's a fine line between stability and stagnation.
Yeah.
And we moved on. Would the church have stagnated had we still been there? I mean, you can't really answer that. You can't really answer that question.
No.
I think in the last year or two that we were there, we started a second congregation. And probably looking back at the history of that second congregation, it's now meeting in Lausanne, I think it has done better than it would have done if I had stayed and had remained and would kept the structure that we had, where I was effectively the pastor of both congregations.
Yeah.
I think it needed somebody else coming in.
Yeah.
To be able to take it on closer to its potential.
Yeah.
So yeah, I came back to Port Stewart, very, very different, culturally very different. You don't have the diversity that you get, obviously, in an international community. Should also say that the church in Switzerland was a non-denominational church.
Yes.
I just, for some reason, prefer that than saying it was an interdenominational church.
Mm-hmm.
Interdenominational, well, not, I don't need to get into the semantics of that, but we were non-denominational.
Yeah.
So we had a variety. We had a variety of traditions, and I think that was good. We didn't, you know, we didn't fall out over too much theology.
Yes.
Although we did have a statement of faith you know. Came back. The church in Port Stewart is a Baptist church. It's an unusual Irish Baptist church in the sense that it's in a holiday resort,
mm-hmm.
very popular North Coast holiday resort. So lots and lots of people come at various seasons of the year.
Mm-hmm.
There was already a fair size, a big congregation of people who were local. You know, there were you know, maybe a few hundred, but then. In the summer, which could have been really from Easter time through to September, the total numbers of people coming through the doors more than tripled, I would say, you know, or tripled, something like that.
Yeah.
So it was that model of church, though, where people were coming in for a season,
mm-hmm.
actually appealed to me.
Yeah, well, you were used to that.
Well, I was used to it. I wasn't used to a situation where you'd have a, you know, one local congregation where there wasn't much change.
Exactly.
And the idea that, and I still think for Port Stewart Baptist, you know, there's a ministry in the local community, but I think Port Stewart Baptist does have an opportunity to be influential across Northern Ireland because people are coming from different parts of the country,
mm-hmm.
and you know, could see models of ministry or, you know, whatever aspects of ministry that would be on display there. I think it has a potential to be a an influencing and influential church.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. Yeah. So you were there for 4 years, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
So let's dive in then into the Christabel experiences. So in our first episode, we talked about the three different kinds. So we've got new territory, reversals, and then isolation. My guess is that you experienced a variety of those through your time, both at Westlake and Port Stewart. Can you talk about maybe your first Christabel as a church leader?
Well, I think I mentioned something about this in a previous podcast. Quite early on, being pitched into a family situation, one of the leader families in the church that was going through, you know, considerable difficulties. This is in Switzerland. I don't really feel I can talk in too much detail about that, but enough to say that there were fairly substantial difficulties. Yeah. And it was people who were, you know, 20 odd years older than me. Those were my parents' generation, really. And that was quite a thing to be landed in that, with the intensity of the pastoral situation.
Yeah.
I think I remember, ending up on the phone with a counsellor back here in Northern Ireland, somebody that we'd heard of, who ended up then eventually coming out and doing some stuff with us in the church. But you sort of look for who's going to help me in this in this particular thing. I think there were lots of things that were learning curves.
Yes.
Some that were more comfortable than others.
Yeah.
I think, you know, going back to the team and the leadership, probably they had to push me a bit to lead.
Okay.
I was probably too reticent, and I think over the years they had to push me to take a bit more of a lead.
Sure.
I can remember then, probably 4 years in.
Yeah.
We used to have, was it 4 years? No, maybe no longer, 6 years in. I'd been appointed, you know, in terms of my contract, it was an open-ended contract, but in terms of the constitution of the church, because I was an elder, I had to be voted on every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that, you know, I see the pros and cons of that in terms of church leadership. But I wasn't voted out after 6 years, but there were a few dissenting voices.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I think it threw me and the elders into a tailspin. We didn't really know what to do.
Was this the first time you were experiencing dissenting voices at that level?
Certainly to that extent. I'm sure, you know, I can't remember, you know, were we hearing criticisms? We may very well have been, you know.
Yeah.
But one of the things that stands out in my mind. And we really didn't know what to do. The elders didn't really know what to do. I think they decided to reappoint me on a 1 year basis and get everything sorted out.
Okay.
That was very, very difficult. It was very difficult for me. It was very difficult for Pauline as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a degree of hurt that comes from that. And, you know, I probably didn't respond, you know, very maturely to it. You tend to become, well, I do, you tend to become very defensive about that sort of thing. Because in the end of the day, you know, you've moved to live in Switzerland, and there are a few people who are basically saying, well, we don't think you should be here, you know, you're not the right person for the church. So where do you go? What, you know, do you go back to teach in Bangor, or have those bridges been burned? What do you do?
Those were the questions going through your mind.
Well, this is me with retrospect. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think in that detail, but I was very afraid, thinking, goodness, what are we going to do? I mean, it wasn't that I'd thought out a bunch of possibilities or anything like that. But as I say, it was frightening. Now, I think this is one of the most significant crucible experiences certainly for me and the elders, because it sort of threw us into crisis. What are we going to do here?
Yeah.
We'd been very, you know, I've said the church was a church that was very resourceful, lots of ideas, you know, we were great with flip charts and all this kind of stuff. I think that sort of brought us a bit to an end of ourselves.
Okay.
And I can remember we would do a weekend or part of a weekend every year that was more for strategic planning and strategic thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we actually listened to a number of talks from Alistair Begg.
Mm-hmm.
We were much more subdued and much more in listening mode and in prayerful mode. through that whole season. And I had felt that, you know, God had spoken to me to reassure me, you know, that this was about me learning to trust Him, and that's what I felt the church, the leadership of the church, needed to do. Out of that came an encounter with a guy from Northern Ireland called David Millen, who was doing church consulting stuff. I met David back in Northern Ireland over the summer, and eventually arranged to have David come to Switzerland. Eventually he came out and spent a couple of weeks with us doing a church-wide consultation. Mm-hmm. Out of that came a vision statement, new vision statement, with a whole sort of several branches of strategic plans, covering different areas of the church. And I mean, I can't put a number of years specifically on this, but I would say that in the providence of God, that vision statement guided us and sustained our ministry for several years into the future.
Yeah. And that came out of that crisis.
It did. It came out of a very painful crisis and what really was a very frightening. I mean, I was in my mid-30s, young family in a foreign country.
Yeah.
Where do you go?
Yeah.
Do you know? So, but out of that, I think, came that lesson of dependence.
Yeah.
And out of that, then came something that I think led to, you know, as I say, it became very strategic for us as a church.
Mm-hmm. Not too long afterwards, you had maybe more personal crucible.
Yeah, it was the hospital thing. I think, again, I talked about this in an earlier podcast, triple bypass surgery.
Mm.
Very frightening,
You were 38 at the time.
Yeah, 38. Far too young for that sort of thing. but very frightening, and I think, you know, an overwhelming sense of vulnerability and fragility in the middle of all of that. That was very difficult. But again, and I think I said this before, it was a time when I felt that God had come very near to me. And, you know, in that kind of crucible of illness, he was definitely there.
And in case we missed the podcast episode where you did talk about that, I mean, I remember you saying that you weren't sure you were going to wake up. You know, after going to sleep the night that you were in hospital waiting your triple bypass. So, how did you feel God close to you? What did that look like?
Well, when I'd been initially diagnosed, even before I was in hospital, I remember, you know, thinking, I mean, your sister at that time was starting to lose her teeth. Oh no, yes, she was starting to lose. Was it her or was it you losing your teeth?
Probably both of us at that time.
Yeah, no, yeah. But anyway, somebody, I think it was her, had lost her first tooth or something like that, you know. And I was actually jet-lagged. I'd been in Canada. And I remember sitting up, couldn't sleep, sitting up jet-lagged with this news about my health and a little box with a little tooth in it and thinking, you know, would I see her grow up? You know, that kind of thing.
Wow.
You know, there was her tooth and would I see her grow, you know. I mean, I could have ended up saying neither of you grow up, you know. So there was a great sense of vulnerability about that.
Yeah.
That was difficult. And then, you know, in the hospital, as I said, you know, I had a little Bible, opened the Bible, and there at the top of the page was, I will lie down and sleep in safety because you, Lord, make me dwell in peace. Or sleep in peace because you make me dwell in safety.
Mm.
And someone a couple of weeks later in America who didn't know that detail of my story wrote to encourage me and put that same verse on it, you know. That kind of thing hasn't happened to me very often.
Mm-hmm.
But when it does, if there's a verse or something in a verse that seems to be, you know, come at me with a repeated pattern.
Yeah.
I kind of think, well, this is what I need to be, what I need to be hearing.
Yeah. So you're in rehab for a month, and Mum learnt how to cook a roast chicken without the skin on. What else happened then in terms of your journey at Westlake? Any other crucibles?
I think we had, I mean, there were things, there were difficult situations towards the end of it. I mean, I don't want to talk, you know, in this kind of setting about too many of the details.
Mm-hmm.
Our unity as an elder group was severely tested.
Yeah.
At a time because of something that happened within the church. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Pauline was caught up in the middle of it all. Mm-hmm. And it was very painful. It was very, very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, there were other other issues around organization of the church, mm-hmm. where I felt that I was kind of, you know, getting on the rough end of some treatment, mm-hmm. Which, you know, they were all around the last couple of years, which I think in the end, unfortunately, and I say this, you know, as I look back on it, I think unfortunately some of the things meant that when I left, I didn't leave strong. Actually, my doctor put me off on burnout for about the last few weeks of my time in Switzerland. And that was, so I felt I hobbled out rather than left, you know, on any sort of high note.
Okay.
Now, I would say that some of the relationships that maybe got strained a bit, you know, have been restored.
Yeah.
And that's been wonderful.
Yeah.
And we have good friends who are back there. And, you know, when we're back in Switzerland, we always love to meet up with this old team. And
yeah.
Some of them were at your wedding and, you know, mm-hmm. all of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And your sister's wedding, which actually happened in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
It was some of those folks were rallying around us to,
they made it happen.
You know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Crucible experiences, they're not always neat.
No.
And I don't think you always end up with a, you know, a sort of a neat, well, I learned ABC and then we all lived happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always happen like that. And
yeah.
I think, you know, some of the leaders that I spoke to in my research had what I would call jagged edges of their stories that are not quite finished,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Around things that they would love to see
yeah.
different.
Yeah.
Disappointments don't always get just resolved
yeah.
again, you know,
mm-hmm.
so that's difficult.
Has your research played a part in helping you process maybe some of those Crucible experiences?
I'm doing it more now,
yeah.
I think,
mm-hmm.
You know, than when I was, because it can be very easy when you're researching. Okay, yeah, we talked yesterday, talked previous podcast, was it autobiographical? And you can listen to the episode 2 on this to find the answer to that question. I think there's a danger as a researcher that you're researching other people's things and you can be a little distant from your own. But then when someone sits down with a microphone and says, right, now we're going to talk about you, it probably forces more. Both the experiences that you know, you can trace a value, and others that you can say, do you know, I really should have handled that better.
Yeah.
I remember a friend when I was going through one of the difficult times in the last couple of years in Switzerland, and I remember a really good friend contacting him, and he's basically saying, look, I'm on your side on this, but your attitude is dreadful.
Wow.
You're becoming really hard.
Wow.
You know, that's great friendship.
Yeah.
And probably in Crucibles we need friends who will do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise we don't, you know, we don't really see what's going on in the Crucible, and I, you know, maybe need to look back on that and think, wow, that defensiveness, mm-hmm. and, you know, allowing myself to lash out
mm-hmm.
at people who I felt were hurting me,
mm-hmm.
that's not a very pretty thing on my
yeah.
part,
yeah.
and you know, but it needs a voice from the outside that's going to come in and challenge that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you can see, you know, obviously in your research you talk about character and spirituality, you can see all those things coming in through these Crucible experiences
yeah.
that you have experienced
yeah.
then.
Yeah. Can I say something about isolation?
Yeah.
I've wondered, you know, the past 6 years, you know, the Port Stewart thing didn't last as long as it might have done. Left after 4 years. And, you know, I think when I left, I had the opportunity to do graduate study, which
yeah.
is what I've done, and sort of worked through this doctorate stuff. It's funny that while I've enjoyed that, and I've enjoyed lots of what I do in terms of teaching and itinerant preaching, and the research has been very, very rich. There's been the odd time, and I've thought, you know, are you isolated here in a bit of a wilderness?
Yeah.
I'm not sure of, well, I don't think so. And I think it's, if it ever was true, I think it's less true now than maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
But that's been an interesting thing to think, you know, I'm maybe somewhat on the sidelines,
mm-hmm.
really not, you know, okay, not that I'm doing nothing. But it's been a bit on the sidelines. And possibly this, you know, this research now is actually going to allow me to make contributions that are a bit more, you know, very different from what I've done before.
Yeah.
But more feeding into where the, you know, where a lot of the action is at.
Yes.
But I did wonder at times, you know, and reflecting about the wilderness and, yeah. you know, particularly the exile experience of Moses and yeah. the desert and all that, you know, his middle years of his life.
Yeah.
You know, I wondered, well, are you sidelined here, you yeah. know? Time will tell. As I say, I don't think I am now. Not, you know,
yeah.
I'm not at the forefront of too much. Maybe I will be a little more as time goes on.
But it's interesting because even in terms of a sports metaphor, you were a player on the field, then you retired to the bleachers to then sort of study the other players on the field. That must have been quite a strange thing.
Got my coaching badges.
Yeah, and now you can coach the players. But I mean, that's a lot of different phases to go through.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I've never been a cutting edge leader, you know, and, you know, maybe if I can help younger people who have more chance of being that,
yeah.
then, you know, I'm teaching leadership in Belfast Bible College, and, you know, maybe if there's an opportunity to have input into the lives of up-and-coming leaders yeah. in whatever years I have left,
yeah.
it's going to be a role that I can fulfill.
Equally, though, I know that you're still processing this, but what would you say to someone who maybe is in a period of isolation? You know, have you come out the other end? Are you able to look back yet? Or were the things that were helpful to you?
Well, I would say to read a book by. I'm going to deflect this a little bit because I haven't got a. I'd need to think through a proper answer to that, and you know, I'm not able to do that right yet.
Yeah.
But I would point people to a book by a woman called Shelley Trebesh.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a little book called Isolation. It was her. She studied under a guy. I think she studied under a guy called Robert Clinton.
Okay.
Who wrote the book The Making of a Leader.
Mm-hmm.
And she picked up one aspect of Robert Clinton's research and called it isolation. Took this idea of isolation. Said almost every leader, 90-95% of leaders undergo some sort of experience of isolation.
Mm.
Sometimes it's voluntary. Sometimes it's involuntary. You know, if someone ends up in a prison cell for 5 years, it's involuntary.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, she goes on and explores just different mm-hmm. ways that the thing can function. I think in the wilderness experience, it's disorienting and it's difficult, but even though God might seem to be far away, he's there. And I think if someone's listening and you are in that kind of experience, don't assume that is the final state of mm. your leadership journey. It may not be over, you know.
Yeah.
I think of Moses at 80, having been for whatever number of years, 40 years in exile. And at 80, he was a sheep farmer. He was kind of pottering about the desert, looking after his father-in-law's sheep. And the furthest thing in his mind was leadership.
Yeah.
Unimaginable that he would have led in the scale that he eventually did lead. And he maybe wondered where God was at all as well, because
mm-hmm.
he thought at 40 that he was doing God's work.
Mm.
And at 80, after the 40 years of exile, that was exactly when God met him. And God met him. I remember noticing this in the text. God met him in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
So a friend of mine who's a Jewish guy and lives in Jerusalem, was our tour guide a couple of times when we were out there a few years ago. I remember him asking us a very interesting question. He's going to take us one day into the desert. And he said, do you go into the desert to stay in the desert, or do you go into the desert to come back? Which is a very profound question. And, you know, historically, you've had monastic movements that have got out of the city and the decadence and so on and got away,
mm-hmm.
and stayed away.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, Jesus himself, he's taken into the desert and then he comes back and he does his ministry. So people yeah. in the desert, you may find that, you know, you've got rich things that are ahead of you.
Mm, that's brilliant. So, well, thank you for sharing your stories uh-huh. and principles, because it's difficult, and I'm sure your participants found that before you found it. but I think it's really important for us to hear your story, and obviously there'll be a lot more to come through the later episodes. Can we close, I guess, on a question of, would you have done the research if you hadn't experienced Crucible, do you think?
That's a good. It's a really good question. I think the way I would say it is, my own experience as a leader, and my own awareness of leadership issues, gave me the antennae to be interested to do it. You know, I think that's it. I mean, I kicked around another idea, and you know, for another reason, I'd let it go. But this one, you know, how a leader is developed through the course of a leadership journey, that has been a fascination for me for a while. And I think my own experiences of leadership have given me the antennae to want to go after it and, you know, to dig in.
Yeah. Great. So where can we find you online?
Okay. Yourleadershipjourney.net. Mm-hmm. You can contact me through that. It would be great if people do want to get in touch and have stories and so on. Thank you for being the guest interviewer.
No problem. It's been a privilege.
Yeah, what I'm going to do in the next episode, I'm actually going to just talk about Moses. Mm-hmm. He's been a fascination to me, and his life as a paradigm of a leadership journey.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about Moses, and then, all being well, as we sort of push this thing further out, I'm going to start having other leaders who are going to be sitting around my table, and I'm going to be back in my more comfortable pose as the interviewer and asking the questions, and I'll get an array of interesting people, and we'll unpack their stories. Hopefully we'll have people from different you know, a lot of church leaders will be there. We'll get leaders from other, you know, from Christian organizations. We'll get some leaders who are Christians who've been leading in secular situations. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned as well, you know, the whole scenario of the unpaid church leader, the elder.
Yeah.
As they say, ministers are paid to be good.
Yeah.
Elders are good for nothing.
If you have questions or even suggestions of episodes, get in touch,
please. Yeah,
and let
absolutely
us know what you think.
Absolutely. If there's any aspect of the leadership journey that you want to hear more about, you know, get in touch.
Fab. Great.
Thank you.
See you next week.
Well, thank you for listening. It's been a long episode this week. I see taking a break next week, and all being well, we'll be back at the beginning of 2018. And as I said there towards the end of that interview, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about Moses. And then beyond that, the plan will be to get some leaders on the other side of the microphone, and I'll be talking to them through the story of their leadership journey. So thanks again for listening. Look forward to talking to you in the new year. Meantime, have a wonderful Christmas.